Well, he is Greek-American. He's a New Yorker.
It's a great American success story.
He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Enlist the support of business leaders, elected officials.
Katsimatidis rubs shoulders with some of the most powerful people in the world.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now that's John Katsimatidis, a native New Yorker.
Mixing common sense thinking with New York sensibility. He's John Katsimatidis, owner of 77 WABC. And this is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the New York City, Long Island division of the Cats Roundtable. John Katsimatidis here. We've got a great show for you today. We have Stephen Moore, our economist. He's going to tell us what the heck is going on. We have Maura Moynihan giving us an update on Chinese relations and what's going on in China. And we have a special James Kallstrom, whose funeral was on Friday with Cardinal Dolan at St. Patrick's Cathedral. And yesterday was the 25th anniversary of Flight 800. Without any further ado, we're starting out with Peter King to tell us about the big event in Coney Island this week. We had a great time in Coney Island on Wednesday night. Margo threw out a perfect pitch for the first game, the Cyclone game. And our co-host that night was Congressman Peter King. And we thought we'd talk about it on Sunday morning, in case you missed that show on Wednesday. Congressman King, how are you this morning?
John, I'm doing great, but I tell you, the greatest night I've had in a long time was at Coney Island on Wednesday night. I have to say, I've seen Jacob deGrom pitch. I've never seen Tom Seaver pitch. Margo's the best. She got the ball down the middle, over the plate. She wasn't nervous at all. All of us were nervous. She was. It was great. But really, it was just a great night.
The only bad news, the Brooklyn Cyclones lost the game 3-2. They should have let Margo pitch.
That was the whole thing. It would have been a shutout. They would have won 2-0 if Margo pitched. She really
absolutely
had the fastball going right down the middle. She was fearless. She was courageous. But it was just a wonderful night. I mean, we had all-time Mets there, all-time greats. You had like Eddie Cranepool and John Franco, Art Shamsky were there. Even Bo Deedle came by. The Maimonides Hospital, which is so important to the community. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful event. Curtis Lee was there. Rudy Giuliani showed up. Rita Cosby. Sid Rosenberg. You gave me the honor of being one of the co-hosts. It was just great having everyone in there. And I was old New York. It was Brooklyn at its best. The setting down there was great. The parachute jump behind the right field line, the cyclone roller coaster in left center field, and the way, again, you have the towers going up, the arc down there. It's just it's wonderful. Brooklyn is back. Brooklyn is back stronger than ever. And it was just a wonderful feeling being there.
Now it's time to make admittances. I ate 5 Nathan's Frankfurters. There's nothing like a Nathan's Frank in Coney Island. How many did you eat, Peter?
I have to admit, John, I only had 2. I couldn't keep up with you, but they are delicious. They're absolutely great. Everything about that night was great. In fact, I went home that night to Long Island, and people told me I had the rain to come down. The Bell Parkway had been flooded, Southern State. I think it was like a brief 10-minute shower, but other than that, when Margo was out there in the field, the sun was shining, the rainbow was there. It was just a wonderful night. The weather was great. The people were great that came by. I mean, it was just you couldn't ask for a better night. I went to high school and college in Brooklyn. I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. I used to go to Ebbets Field. And being there with the Cyclones, and you and Margo and the whole WABC team, it was like having a family night out.
And I went to Brooklyn Tech High School, so Brooklyn was always close to my heart. I learned, I grew up in Harlem, but Brooklyn Tech made me have a come out and came out of my shell. And I learned a lot about the world going to Brooklyn Tech. And we built those 2 beautiful towers on Coney Island, right on the beach. Sidney Rosenberg stayed in one of the corporate apartments, and he doesn't want to leave. What do I do?
You may have to get a really good eviction lawyer, because Sid told me he's not moving. He was holding on to those keys, and he was saying he was working out there. He got the sun. He was going on and on about it. I think you're going to have a squatter there. I don't know how you're going to get rid of him, John. You're going to have to get a tank or something to get him out of there. He was going on about.
I know. I mean, well, maybe we'll lock him out when he comes to work on Monday morning. Yeah. But you know, we have a philosophy. I told Sid, you breathe in that ocean air, I guarantee you will live 10 years longer. What say you?
And you have Alan Dershowitz. Well, I believe it. And you also said that Alan Dershowitz will represent you if someone sues, or they only live for 9.5 years rather than 10 extra years. But no, it's beautiful. And I think it shows your commitment to the community, too. I mean, the faith that you have in Brooklyn, you know, the money that's being invested there in those towers. And Brooklyn is really, it's back. It's coming back. It's coming back stronger than ever. And it's so important. It's such an integral part of New York. It's a unique place in New York. It stands by itself, and it is back so strong. And it's again, I couldn't have. I just had the night of my life. It was absolutely great being there and seeing those ball players coming back, seeing the enthusiasm, seeing your friends who were there. It was just a wonderful night.
In Brooklyn, people love Brooklyn. If Brooklyn was a city in itself, it'd be the fourth largest city in the country. And promoting Coney Island on behalf of Maimonides Hospital, on behalf of Nathan's, on behalf of the Aquarium, on behalf of the Brooklyn Cyclones. Everybody loves Coney Island, and I say to everybody, come on down and come on back. And you know what I would say to all our friends in Miami that were New Yorkers? It's time to come back and breathe in that ocean air up here. It's better.
And get a nice unit in your towers.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter King. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, and we'll catch up again real soon. Thank you for co-hosting the Coney Island special event.
No, thank you. Thank you for being part. It was really an historic evening for me, so thank you, John.
What's going on with the economy? With us this morning is Stephen Moore, and one of the top five economists in our country. Good morning, Stephen Moore. Give us an update. What's going on with the markets? What's going on with the economy? The market's down 300 points.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the economy is strong right now, no question about it. We see businesses reopening all over the country. People are getting out. This summer, travel is amazing. All of the flights are getting filled up. All of the hotels are getting filled up. And that's one of the reasons the prices of these things are going up. So, you know, I like the direction of things right now, but I'm worried about two things. And one of them, obviously, is the inflation report we got this week, which was really, you know, disturbing. We are seeing 5 to 6% rate of inflation, and for electric items they buy, you're seeing furniture prices rise, gasoline prices rise, you're seeing food prices rise, you're seeing airline tickets rise. All of these things are going up, and I think the Fed
Stephen
is
Moore,
in the curve.
I predicted this 60 days ago, nobody has bought me a cup of coffee yet.
Well, the only person who agreed with you was me. And so we have inflation now, and the Fed is not taking action. Now, the other thing that really concerns me, though, that I think is a real crisis at hand, is this $3.5 trillion that Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden have agreed to push a bill with all of this extra spending. By the way, people should understand that's on top of the $4 trillion budget we already have, and also on top of the $1.9 trillion we spent earlier this year. I believe these people are acting like we have an unlimited credit card. I think they're using the COVID crisis and its aftermath to rebuild a massive welfare state. And you saw what happened this week where the federal government started sending out checks to people. For every child they have, you get $300 per month. I mean, I don't like these policies, John, because they're not tied to work. They're not tied to your contribution to the economy. And I think what you've got is a massive income redistribution plan that is going to lead to.
In other words, you stay home, collect $300 per child of OPM, other people's money, and just stay, take it easy. No, nobody has to go to work. We just print money. How long do people really think that could go on?
How long can you fool people? Well, look, this is America. One thing you know about Americans, and we all know about Americans, we love free things. So if the government's going to give people free money, they're going to gobble it up for sure. But the problem is, as I said, it's not tied for work. You're right. It's other people's money. You know, the only way that the government can give me $1,000 is to take $1,000 away from you. The government doesn't create money. So what happens when people get all this money, John, and they go out and spend it? Well, what does that do to prices? It's going to lead to more inflation. So my message, especially to Republicans, do not buy into this. We should actually be cutting back on the spending now that the economy is recovering and the crisis is over. And right now we're doing just the opposite.
in the stock market. The banking stocks were a little bit apprehensive this week. Interest rates keep sinking. What say you about that?
Well, I'm going to say this, John. I think people have to be very aware of the problem of inflation. And inflation is a killer of bull market rallies. You know, you saw what happened in the 70s with inflation. It just killed the market. So inflation is not a good thing for stocks. I think investors have to be very nervous about the increase in the prices, because what happens is bonds become more attractive and stocks become less attractive. So I want the Fed to stop buying all these mortgages. I want them to stop buying up the debt. And it's time to start taking some of this extra monetary liquidity out of the market, not put more of it in.
Stephen Moore, thank you so much for coming on. God bless you and God bless America.
Thanks, John.
You're a great American. You're a classic example of the people who built this country.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
This is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's John Catsimatidis.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Katzenfeld here, Sunday morning. We all worry about America and what's going on and the reasons it's going on. With us this morning is Maura Moynihan. She is the daughter of former Senator Patrick Moynihan. And she has certain concerns and she wants to voice them. Good morning, Maura. How are you this morning?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me, John.
You were telling me before that you have concerns about a program that's been around since 1959, and all of a sudden the White House is canceling it. Tell all America about it.
In 1959, President Eisenhower created Captive Nations Week to honor victims of communism. And every year until this week, the White House has always issued a proclamation recognizing and acknowledging the millions of victims of communist regimes. And for the first time in history, the Biden White House is not going to do that. Why? Well, many people are asking this question with some trepidation, because the threat of communism is as dangerous now as it was in the Cold War with the rise of a bellicose communist China. And the White House said they're going to change the name. It will no longer be Captive Nations Week. They're playing around with the language. And, of course, a great many Chinese, Tibetan, Uyghur, Vietnamese, and Cambodian exiles and dissidents are very concerned about this. And they're asking, why would the White House do this unless they were trying to pay back China or do a favor for communist China? And this certainly does not benefit the people of China, who are first and foremost the victims of the one-party totalitarian dictatorship that is the People's Republic of China.
Understood. Has the White House said at all why, what their reasoning is? It's a program that's been in effect for like 60 years now.
That's correct. No, they haven't given a explanation as to why there's this sudden change in acknowledging the egregious human rights abuses committed by communist regimes. There are millions of men, women, and children in concentration camps in Western China, mostly Tibet and Xinjiang, as we speak, tortured and enslaved with methods of cruelty that would make Stalin or Hitler proud. And this action by the White House sort of diminishes their suffering and what the human rights atrocity being committed in the 21st century.
See, Maura, this is what I don't understand. They're busy taking down statues of George Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson for something that happened 200 years ago, but nobody speaks out the atrocities going on in China or the rest of the world. I even told my gay friends. I told them about Iran, and they almost have a sports of taking gays on the roof and just pushing them off the roof. It's almost a sport in Iran. Well, what say you?
Well, the same in China. Homosexuality is against the law. It's considered a criminal activity under the laws of the People's Republic of China. And, you know, you see this just the left in this country seems to have captured most of our mainstream media, doesn't even cover communist China and these atrocities. And And also the capture of Hong Kong last year. Hong Kong was the world's third largest capital market. It used to be free. It had British common law. Well, now it is a communist state where you can go to jail for life for the crime of counter-revolutionary thought. That just means questioning the Chinese Communist Party. I don't see any coverage of this coming from our networks and very little from our newspapers. So the American people are not being well informed either.
Now, you got to learn most of these things. You were out in that area. And where were you? Thailand? Where your father
India.
Was an ambassador? India.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was the greatest experience of my life, John. When I was 15 years old, President Nixon appointed my father the American ambassador to India. And I went with my entire family, and I attended high school there. And I also met the Tibetan refugee community and the Dalai Lama. And then I had a very unusual experience. As we were leaving democratic India, we had the opportunity to visit George and Barbara Bush. He was the liaison ambassador in Beijing. It was then called Peking. We didn't have full diplomatic relations. And the Cultural Revolution was still going on very strong, and Chairman Mao was still alive. And the difference in the society between communist China and democratic India was astonishing. In India, there was a middle class, there was places of worship, there was arts, there was a free press. In communist China, there were none of those things. People were frightened, people were standing up in line for one bag of rice in front of the People's Commune. And while the Chinese economy has opened up, that one-party totalitarian dictatorship is still the form of government. In fact, it's hardened under Xi Jinping. And I think that, again, the business community is also downplays the risks of investing in China. And, millions and millions of dollars of pension funds from Americans are invested in People's Liberation Army military companies. And why is it that Chinese firms are exempt from audits in the New York Stock Exchange? This was a law passed under Obama-Biden in 2013. But why? American companies, as you know, are subject to audits. European companies are. Why do they get this exemption?
It's frightening. And the fact, your dad was a democratic liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, those words have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these people that want to change America, I don't call them liberals. I've been calling them regressives because they want to tear down America. Do you think they're being funded by any particular group?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that the Chinese Communist Party has been funding Antifa for a very long time. Last year, they gave Antifa $100 million to, as you said, destroy statues, to burn courthouses, to desecrate churches. And I've still yet to see one story about this in the New York Times. And the Chinese Communist Party 2 years ago walked away from a trade deal with the Trump administration and Lighthizer and Navarro, and declared a people's war on the United States. Most Americans are not aware of this, but they use the doctrine of unrestricted warfare, which means information warfare, of spreading a bioweapon, locking down our societies, which they push through the World Health Organization. And the failure of media to report on this puts the American people at a great disadvantage. And they also, through a lot of front companies, the Chinese Progressive Association, based in a chapter in Boston, the other in San Francisco, has given millions and millions of dollars to candidates. So, yes, it's a very serious issue, and it doesn't get as much coverage as it should.
Well, Maura Moynihan, please stay on top of this, and please come back in subsequent weeks to report on it and let the American people know the truth, because WABC Radio stands for the truth.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate what you're doing. It's very important.
With us today is Benny Bosio, and he is the president of the New York City Corrections Officers, 20,000 of them, retired and active. Good morning, Benny. How are you this morning?
I'm good, John. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I'm glad you called in, because I hear that you are worried. Things are not going as good as you want them to be. Fill in all New Yorkers. What's going on with the Corrections Officers Association?
Well, we're having the roughest time in my 22-year career ever. Officers are working triple shifts, which includes 24 hours straight, 25 hours plus hours, some cases 30 hours straight. And it's a really unsafe situation for us. The department has housed inmates by affiliation, and it's inhumane treatment that the city's workforce, you know, has to go through. My correction officers are suffering. And basically, we filed a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections and the Department of Labor. You know, we're trying to force the Department of Labor to provide a safe and healthy working environment to the DOC. So, you know, the lawsuit gives a firsthand account of the department's failures to provide basic necessities, you know, officers' medical attention. You know, it's terrible for us. You know, they're not providing us with medical attention in a timely fashion, not providing us meal reliefs after working all of those hours, three creative tour, no restroom breaks. Officers that have to breastfeeding, they are not providing time for female officers to be able to go to a separate location to pump their breast milk for their babies. So this is really an unsafe situation and deplorable for them to be treating us this way.
Well, it sounds like it. I also understand that you have a lot of resignations and people trying to move over to the NYPD. What say you about that?
Yeah, it's a tragedy. You know, the department has historically not up with staffing levels for correction officers. They haven't hired correction officers in over 2.5 years. And people, the deplorable conditions have forced correction officers to leave this job and jump ship and go to the NYPD. That's how it's gotten for us. Over 1,000 resignations since January of 2019. I mean, we're dealing with broken cell doors. They're housing inmates by gang affiliation. There are no response teams to provide emergency service to our correction officers when they hit their personal body alarm, when they're being under attack by a correction by an inmate. This is the state that we are in today.
Well, that doesn't sound so good. This is bad. And, you know, I was sad because I know Bill de Blasio for 25 years, and he's a smart guy. I was sad that he turned down additional help from the White House for more NYPD or more patrol officers, which I'm sure that the corrections would have been, department would have been helped by it, too. What else would you like to tell all New Yorkers? We've got about a minute or so left.
Oh, look, I just want all New Yorkers to understand that, you know, it's truly a shame the way, you know, this city has treated correction officers. We answered the call during COVID. We came to work every day. We're essential workers, first responders. And this is how New York City correction officers are being treated by the city of New York and this agency. And it's truly a shame. It's truly a shame. The city has to respond to the suit by August 23rd. You know, it shouldn't take us to have to sue to get, you know, health and safety issues in this day and age. You know, it's truly a shame.
Let me ask you for a scoreboard. How many, you've been with the Corrections Department a long time. You've been president for just recently. How many Rikers inmates do you have right now?
We're close to 6,000 inmates right now.
And if I asked you that question 5 years ago, 6 years ago, how many would it have been?
Maybe
give or take.
Maybe 8,000.
And look, and like I've said publicly, I don't care that they let people out because they're on marijuana charges, but on inmates that have threatened the public with guns, knives, pistols. Are those people being put away, or are they just getting a parking ticket and go home?
I mean, you tell me, John. There's like 11 shootings a day. It's the city has become extremely unsafe. You know, and when the new mayor takes office and they talk about cleaning up the city of New York, well, guess where everybody's going to be sent to? Rikers Island. And we need 2,000 correction officers to help us be able to man the population. So, you know, our city has gone to shame. It's terrible. Safe. People are afraid to take the subway, John. I mean, look, and when they do decide to clean it up, they're all coming to Rikers Island.
Understood. Thank you, Benny.
Benny Bassio.
Benny Bassio, president of the Corrections Union. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of the weekend.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
I went to a funeral Friday morning. It was for a great lawman, former assistant director of the FBI, Jim Kallstrom. He's the one that investigated Flight 800. And in the last week or two is the 25th anniversary of Flight 800. Here's an interview we did a few years ago with Jim Kallstrom about Flight 800. Let's go to it.
A few weeks ago was a big anniversary of Flight 800. Do you still feel the same way of Flight 800? A lot of people say that you were forced into that decision. And
well, that's crazy. I mean, some people do say that, John. I know.
Well, I had lunch with Carl Icahn the other day, and he still believes it was terrorism.
Well, Carl Icahn is a smart guy, but he, you know, that opinion, I don't know where he would get such a crazy opinion. First
so
off,
you stand by your original
Flight 800? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We looked at it every which way but Sunday. We looked at every piece of that plane multiple times. We hired outside experts. You know, we went over and over and over again. You know, the FBI is not going to stand up and say it wasn't terrorism if we weren't absolutely sure that that was the case. And that is the case. I would have doubted that at the very beginning. I thought it certainly was terrorism. 747s don't blow up like that. But the reality is it wasn't. People are, you know, they're welcome to their opinion. But I'll tell you, if Bill Clinton ever called me and told me not to tell the truth, that would be my opportunity to have a press conference and discuss that conversation, because I wasn't a big fan of the Clinton administration.
James Kallstrom, thank you. Former director of the FBI, thank you for being with us this Sunday morning and talking to the American people.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, John.
And God bless the life of Jim Kallstrom, a great FBI assistant director. Thank you for being with us for the Catch Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Catch Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. So we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.
Well, he is Greek-American. He's a New Yorker.
It's a great American success story.
He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Enlist the support of business leaders, elected officials.
Katsimatidis rubs shoulders with some of the most powerful people in the world.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now that's John Katsimatidis, a native New Yorker.
Mixing common sense thinking with New York sensibility. He's John Katsimatidis, owner of 77 WABC. And this is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, America. This is the national edition of the Cats Roundtable. John Katsimatidis here. We have a great show for you today. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. My God, what the secrets and things he's going to tell us about our country. We have Larry Kudlow. The economy, Dr. Mikhalos. And let's go to Dick Morris to tell us what's going on in Washington. He was a strategist for President Bill Clinton, a strategist for President Donald Trump, and he's got his ear to the ground. Good morning, Dick Morris. How are you this morning?
Hey, Kat. I'm doing great. Doing fine, as you can in 94-degree weather.
Well, it's getting hot. And tell us, I mean, what a mess we have with immigration. We're telling the Cuban immigrants, stay where you are. Let the Castro Association, associated people, mow you down. Meanwhile, the Central Americans, so we say, come on in. What's going on?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with how they vote. On the one hand, the Cubans are really overflowing now with anger at the regime because of COVID and the economy is falling apart, and they all want to leave. And it's like the days of the Mariel boat lift decades ago. And the U.S. announced yesterday that it is robustly, that's their word, patrolling the Caribbean with ships to stop immigrants from crossing the Caribbean and coming to the U.S. from Cuba. But But then on the other hand, they absolutely opened the border in Mexico. You can stroll across. If you happen to get arrested, you get released a few hours later. It's no big deal. And there's no effort to deport anybody or to catch people that they let in before. And over a million have come in since the first of the year. So why are we turning Cubans away but inviting Mexicans to come in? And I think it has everything to do with politics. I think the Democrats know that a Cuban that they bring in is very likely to be a Republican. Not that Cuba's all that Republican, but that they lived under communism and socialism, and they know how terrible it is. And when they see Antifa and Black Lives Matter and all of that stuff, they know what's going on because it happened to them under Castro. And that's why they voted for Trump, and it's why they would continue to vote Republican. So the administration is hell on wheels, cracking down on them. But the Mexican community, which it hopes will vote Democrat, although increasingly Mexicans are voting Republican too, their attitude is, hey, come on in. We're not going to stop you. We're not going to bust you at the border, and free for all. And I think that has everything to do with politics.
So in other words, if Cubans come in, it's politics because they're most likely the Cubans will vote Republican because they know what life under communism is. Is that what it is?
Yep.
And Central Americans, they will be thankful to the Democratic Party for allowing them in.
Yep. Today's Sunday, so let me take a moment and talk about football. The NFL just announced that it's going to play the Black National Anthem, in addition to the American National Anthem, at all of its games in the 2021 season. And the Black National Anthem, I don't know if you've ever read the lyrics or heard it, but it's not...
I could never identify. If you paid me $1 million today and you asked me to identify it, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, it's not bad. The music isn't that great, but it basically is just the lyrics talk about slavery and how terrible it was and how we've been through such suffering and such pain, and now we're free and all of that. And there's nothing anti-American about it. It wouldn't be a problem. But I believe that what's going on here is a complicated cop-out by Major League Football, by the NFL. The real issue with them is integrating their game. 75% of the players are African-American, but none of the owners are African-American. Four of the coaches of about 30 teams are African-American. There were seven or eight, and they cut it back to four. And to forestall demands for the real change, which is to integrate ownership and coaching, that they're scared to death of, they can talk about this phony issue of playing the song, and that way they hope they can escape blame and liability and continue their blatant discrimination in letting minority owners into the NFL and not putting minority coaches into top positions, even though they're the overwhelming majority of the really good players.
Now, what do you think of the new $3 trillion bill that the Democrats are proposing?
Congress. Well, look, first of all, it reminds me of nothing so much as a cow chewing its own cud. You know, a cow eats grass, but then it stays in its mouth, and sometimes it regurgitates it, and it swallows it again, and the cow must think he's eating, but he's not. He's just eating yesterday's or last night's meal. That's just what this package reminds me of. It's $3 trillion in new spending, and we're giving it to for climate change and for daycare and for Medicare and for highways and for everything you can think of. But it's your old money. It's money you've already eaten, because what they're doing is giving you money that is going to increase inflation, that will raise prices, that will, with its right hand, take back what it gave you with its left hand. So you're going to get a job, you're going to get a good wage, but the price is going to go up by enough to nullify everything you just got. And they give you the appearance of being rich, the appearance of moving up economically, but in fact you can stay the same or perhaps drop back. And what the administration is doing is trying to con the American people into believing that they're really making progress. But there's one other thing in that package that drives me totally crazy. Kat, I'm going to be talking about it today on my radio show at noon. There's a provision that changes the capital gains tax, raises it. But more importantly, it's setting it up so that they can take your house. It's ending inheritance in America. What it says is that right now, if you own the house and it goes up in value and then you die, your heirs don't have to pay for the increase in value that happened while you were alive. They start at zero with when they inherited it. Biden's changing that. He wants to make it so that when you die, your son and your daughter have to pay for the value of the property that it is at your death, have to pay the capital gain on that. And if they don't pay it, they lose the house. So let's say you bought a house for $100,000. Now it's worth $300,000. And you die. And your heirs pick it up. And the government says, oh, this is worth $300,000. It used to be worth $100,000. That's a $200,000 capital gain. You got to pay me 40% of that. So you got to pay me the difference. And the problem is that you never got the money. It was never sold. They're just saying if it were to be sold, it would be worth $200,000, but it hasn't been sold. So you don't have
so
the money.
So they're taking, in other words, they want to tax middle America right off the bat like that.
Yeah, it's not even a tax cut. It says it's a tax. It's a taking. It's eminent domain. It's a confiscation. Because they know damn well that you don't have that money. You never had that money. Your property was never sold. In fact, that if it were sold, it might sell for $200,000. Doesn't mean you have $200,000. You don't. And yet they're going to tax you as if you had it.
I got one more question, and we're running out of time. I want to ask you the question. And you're a smart guy, and we were both Democrats. We're both Republicans. And, you know, we both have common sense. The fact, Black America was traditionally 95% Democratic. And I think it's increased right now. A lot of them, almost 20%, are going Republican. There's smart people, and they love America, the Black people. They love America.
Not that many, Kat.
Yeah.
Not that many, Kat.
Well, that's what I heard lately.
12% are Republican.
Okay, 12%. Do you think they realize? Do you think they realize what's going on in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, but I don't think they mind it. I kept talking in the Trump campaign. They kept saying, let's go after the Black vote. And I said, you can go after it all day long. You're never going to get it. Go after the Hispanic vote. That's what you can get. And in the election, Trump went up 3 points among Blacks and 10 points among Hispanics and 6 points among Asians. He really soared in those groups. And those are people who came to America voluntarily. They chose to come here. They risk their lives in many cases to come here. And they know that when the Antifa and that crowd starts pulling down America, they're paving the way for the socialism that these guys just fled. And that, I think, is the answer. I think the Black community is still hypnotized by the Black leadership into believing that this, they're all they
are. My opinion, I think they're changing. But I want to thank you again, Dick Morris, for coming on the show and letting America know what's going on and keeping your ear close to the ground. God bless you. God bless America. And let's tell everybody not to forget to listen to your regular show Sundays, WABC, from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock. It's a great show, and I look forward to it again every week.
Thank you, Jack.
Telling it like it is, giving you both sides of the story with common sense thinking. It's the Cats Roundtable.
After the market closed on Friday, Larry Kudlow came on Friday show, and it was so good, again, I thought we should replay it this Sunday morning. Larry, how is our country doing?
Well, our country's economy is doing great, and even though the market was off today, the stock market's doing great. You've got huge profits. You've got free money. Yeah, there's some temporary inflation, but the market has been seeing through that. The only problem the country's got, if you ask me, is this woke budget resolution from the Democrats, which would raise taxes by, I don't know, $3.5 trillion. Also reports, you know, this crazy idea that we're going to let Europe and foreign countries tax our corporations, give them the power, which is probably unconstitutional. But the market's very uneasy. The market's very uncertain how much of that stuff's going to pass. And rest of the story is great. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And if you ask me, this budget resolution is This is a solution in search of a problem.
And the interest rates keep dropping. The bank stocks, even though they had reasonably good earnings, I don't know, how do you interpret it, have been falling. Is it an opportunity for bank stocks? I mean, they are loaded with money. They can buy back all their stock. What say you?
Yeah, well, listen, the banks are loaded with cash. Their profits are very good. The stocks didn't do much the last day or two, but the stocks have been strong. So that's a very good sign. I will say it's interesting that bond rates have been falling. You wouldn't think that if we are worried about inflation. So maybe the inflation is temporary. You know, something really bullish, I'm not sure people paid attention to it, but Taiwan Semiconductor Company, which is the world's largest producer of, you know, kind of general merchandise, commodity-type semiconductors. So they are now amping up their production. I think I read they're going to increase production by 60%. That's going to fill in a lot of the supply shortages, like in the car business, right? You can't produce enough cars, so used car prices have been huge, distorting the CPI. I love it that Taiwan Semiconductor is going to boost their chip production. That's a very bullish thing.
There is a shortages of lumber, the shortages of chips, the shortages of everything. What do you project out over the next 90 days? You feel that that's going to level itself out?
I do. My hunch is you're going to get some lousy inflation numbers for another month or two, but I think we're pretty close to the peak, and that's what the bond market is telling you. And so, you know, take lumber. Lumber prices skyrocketed. Lumber prices have been crashing. Okay, they're down more than 60% in recent weeks. I don't know, it's been about a month. So that's going to make housing a lot cheaper to build. And if some of these local municipalities would fix their regulations, we could build even more housing. But the housing sector's been good. Cheaper lumber is going to really help. You had very good numbers on retail sales. Today, surprisingly strong sales numbers. Before that, we had very strong manufacturing, industrial production. All that looked very good. So, you know, I think, as usual, the obstacles are coming out of the swamp in Washington, and we don't know how that story is going to turn out. But I think fundamentally, you know, you get a day like today, you lose 300 points. You certainly stick with your guns, and you might think about buying the dip. That's my best advice. Buy the dip. Of course, that's what I always say. Buy the dip.
We got a couple minutes left. What would you like to tell all Americans on the middle of July and the market being seesawing and interest rates are down a little bit?
You know, keep your chin up. Things are getting – the economy is booming. People going back to work. Rates are low and profits are high and everybody's making money. Businesses are opening left and right. I mean, I think the most interesting story in the last 24 or 48 hours, John, is Madam Psaki, Biden's press secretary. You know, she let the cat out of the bag. There is collusion. The Biden White House has been talking to Facebook about what they should allow on their platform or what they should not allow. That's exactly the collusion and censorship that President Trump has been writing about in his op-ed piece that he's brought a lawsuit. And they just kind of leaked it out. I don't think they intended to. They tried to walk it back, and now it looks even worse. And Facebook just came out with a statement saying, well, yeah, we actually have been in touch with the Biden White House about things, for example, discussing COVID and what not to do and what to do and getting vaccines. You know, that's kind of craziness that permeates the swamp. Trump was right. We now got fresh evidence of that. Everybody hates censorship. This is not a country that believes in Big Brother watching over you. We'll leave that to the crazy communists in Cuba and Venezuela and China. America is a different place. So I think, actually, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Finally, the cat's out of the bag. The toothpaste has been squeezed out of the tube, and now we can go to work and stop the censorship by these big media tech companies. That's an important thing, and it broke last night and today.
Larry Kudlow, thank you so much for coming on, and And have a great weekend. Hopefully the sun will shine this weekend.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Drugs. They're killing our people. They're killing our students. They're killing our youngsters. Our witness today is Lucas Nefertaris, and he is Executive Vice President of SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana. Good morning, Lucas. How are you this morning?
Doing very well, John. Thank you for the honor of having me on.
Now, give us an update. We talked a few years ago. We talked about what harm the marijuana is doing to some of our youth and other people. Give us an update. Where are we?
Yeah. So, you know, many of you may have seen, you know, now Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer with a couple of other senators released a bill this last week called the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act. And that is a federal piece of legislation to legalize marijuana across the country. And, you know, it's a little crazy because the day they unveiled that bill was the same day we saw in the news that 90,000 people died from drug overdoses last year in this country. And so it was kind of, you know, very unfortunate timing that both those things happened at the same time. And it just kind of reminded us that, you know, our country is in the middle of an addiction crisis. Drugs are literally killing people all across our country. And yet here we are. We have Senator Schumer and a number of other Democrats in the Senate who are trying to push to federally legalize marijuana and let a whole new industry make a bunch of money off of this drug and addict a lot of people. And it's just kind of a crazy situation we're in right now, John.
Now, originally, I understand, you know, President Trump had stopped fentanyl, and then the Chinese found a different way of sending it in. How bad is the problem getting, and how is it affecting our youth? Because I've talked to many neurologists and many doctors, and they said, if 12 years old, 14 years old, 16 year olds get into those that marijuana, it could hurt their intelligence level. What say you?
Yes, yes. No, it's a real problem, but, you know, for everybody, but particularly for our youth. Because what's happened is, you know, I'm from Colorado. We were the first state to legalize marijuana, and you know, ever since my state legalized in 2014. There was a brand new industry that came into play. It's invested in by big tobacco, alcohol, pharma. And we saw marijuana change. It is now sky high potency. So, you know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, marijuana on average was about 3% potency. Now the dabs and the waxes and the concentrates they're selling are up to 99% potency. So it's a totally different drug. It is so much more powerful, so much more addictive. And so our kids are getting into it. So we saw just about every single state that's legalized marijuana see a huge increase in youth use of the drug just in the last 2 years. And so we're hoping that, you know, that doesn't continue. But, you know, the states that legalize marijuana, they're seeing a lot more use among our youth. And so it hurts the mind. It prevents their brain development. It causes a permanent IQ loss of 6 to 8 points. And then we're also seeing, you know, with this high potency stuff, we're seeing psychosis and schizophrenia, all kinds of mental health conditions that we've really never seen before from this drug. And so the research is just starting to come out on that. But very, very frightening stuff we're starting to see with this brand new drug. And so, you know, that's why it kind of makes it a little crazy that we're even thinking about federally legalizing this industry when they're selling products that are starting to hurt people more and more and addict people more and more. You know, it's so funny. You look at this bill that Schumer introduced. It doesn't have the word children in it. It doesn't have the word addiction in it. It doesn't have the word potency in it. You know, these are things that you would expect a bill to protect the public. These things are out of this bill. So it's a nightmare in terms of what they're looking at right now.
I worry most about the kids, what parents should do in their schools or their communities. You know, I live in Long Island on weekends, and the Long Island towns have to opt in or opt out. You know, some people will say, oh, look at all this new tax money we're going to get. But I think it's nickels and dimes. I don't know. What say you?
Oh, yeah. No, the tax money, unfortunately, is the biggest myth of this whole thing. So, we're partly based in New York. We've done a lot of work in New York over the last several years. And so the projected tax revenue for the state of New York after 3 years of you guys having implemented this program. So they're saying 3 years from now, when it's a mature marijuana market and, you know, everything's set up, they project your tax revenues are going to be less than a fraction of 1% of your state budget. So the money is pennies on the dollar for what New Yorkers can expect. And that's what we've seen everywhere. I mean, I'm here in Colorado. My state's making the most money off of marijuana out of all the states, and ours is 0.9% of our state budget. So it's for us, too. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, you'll hear advocates for marijuana, like our former governor here in Colorado, who's now a U.S. senator, Senator John Hickenlooper. He's in support of legalization, but he says don't legalize it for the money. So, you know, the money is not going to be a big thing in New York. I hate to break it to you. You know, we did some, you know, cost studies on just the local impact to the county level, emergency services, law enforcement, you know, regulation, et cetera. And that alone is going to eat up the lion's share of whatever money's made in the state. So that, you know, is a very, very unfortunate thing, but it's unfortunately, it's just true. You're not going to make a lot of money off this drug. And then, you know, you're going to have to worry about driving. You know, it's really interesting about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, there was that very infamous limo accident you guys had in the city where the driver was high on marijuana, crashed the limo, and a whole bunch of people died and got injured. And that actually stopped the legalization push in the state of New York for a while because everybody realized what happens with that stuff. So, you know, we've seen about a 70% increase in our marijuana impaired driving deaths in Colorado since we legalized. So, you know, that unfortunately, you're going to really need to watch the impaired driving.
70% increase in Colorado in what, automobile deaths?
Yep, people dying from marijuana-impaired drivers. So people getting stoned and then driving on the roads, getting into a crash and killing somebody.
And that somebody might be you or me. The other big concern is marijuana being a gateway drug. What say you about that?
That's a great question. So, yeah, there's a lot of research on this topic. What I can tell you is this. The research is rock solid that 99% of people who use opioids, you know, illicit opioids like fentanyls, heroin, et cetera, 99% of those people started with marijuana. So we know there's a link between marijuana and other drugs.
Let's get that number right. 99% of people on hard drugs started with marijuana. Well,
that is absolutely right.
Wow. Wow. Go ahead.
Now, yep. And now does that mean that, you know, you smoke a joint and you're going to pick up a heroin needle and start injecting heroin? You know, not necessarily. That's not for everybody. But what that tells us is that drugs are linked. You know, people think, oh, you just use alcohol or, oh, you just use marijuana. That's just not true. And marijuana, whether people like it or not, has a way of kind of smoothing the path to other drugs. And there's just no way of getting around that. That's what the research tells us.
Well, Lucas, thank you so much for reporting in. Anything else you want to tell the American people? We have about 30 seconds left.
Check out Learn About Sam.org. Learnaboutsam.org. That's our website. God bless.
Learn
thank you, John.
Learnaboutsam.org. Well, thank you, Lucas, for coming on. And look, I'm not totally against it. Medical marijuana is good for a lot of people, I'm sure. But driving with marijuana influence, driving a truck, doing construction equipment, that's the fear that I have. And God bless everything you're doing, Lucas. And God bless America. Thank you.
Thank you, John. God bless.
Here's the man who is New York, exploring the truth, telling both sides with common sense thinking. Here's John Catsimatidis on Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is the Cats Roundtable.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Catsimatidis. Yes, Sunday morning. The medical stuff going on. Is something changes every week, every day. With us today is Dr. Peter Michlos, and he's our in-house medical expert. And today's topic, the attack of the mutant viruses. Good morning, Dr. Michlos. How are you?
Good morning, John. Good morning, Cats Roundtable audience. And it's great to be here to update everyone on what's happening because the news keeps changing. But
the aliens are fighting back.
Yeah, that's it. Well, these little microscopic, you know, predators are being quite aggressive. And, you know, we have in our microbiome, in our own gut, we have tons of viruses and bacteria that over time have learned to coexist with us and live with us. but this one hasn't achieved that goal yet. But first of all, I want to just tell the audience, we've got to go through some bottom line facts to educate people. And the bottom line is that 99% of the people who died from COVID in the last month in the United States were unvaccinated people. You can still catch COVID even if you're vaccinated, but the hospitalization and death rate is very, very low. And the bottom line is, for all the anti-vaxxers out here, you have a 1 in 500 chance of dying if you catch COVID, but you have a 1 in a million chance of dying from a vaccine, whether it's the U.S. or the Russian vaccine. You know, those are the statistics. And the new strain has changed its spike protein, which is like a regular key that enters the door of your body's cells. And think about it, that this now has changed and it's become a digital key card that gets into your door of your cell 60% faster to infect us than the previous version. So this version of this Delta variant that started in India, thought to start in India, is 60% more contagious. And that's part of the problem, that it wants to live, the virus, so it needs to find a new hotel. And the way this started, viruses basically jumped from bats and discovered that there's 7 billion new hotels called human beings, us, who had no antibodies to fight it or any type of defense, making us prime targets. And the virus wants to survive and eventually learn to coexist with us. As we just discussed, we have a lot of virus and bacteria in our system that we coexist with. But now we're dealing with this new variant, and the hospitalizations are up in the United States. We're fortunate that 50% of the U.S. population is vaccinated, and thank God, you know, President Trump did Operation Warp Speed, did an amazing job of giving us the vaccines, and the Biden administration has done an excellent job of distributing the vaccines. And, for example, in Missouri, only a small percentage are vaccinated, and that's why they found 12% of hospitalizations with the Delta variant have been found in places like the Mississippi. And there's also now we know that 111 countries have identified this new variant. And we're seeing in the United States 25,000 new cases a day. And they're mostly around the low vaccinated states like Arkansas, Missouri, Texas, and Nevada. And we're seeing those new cases in the areas where we have a lower vaccination rate. And Europe is having a big problem now that everybody's going on vacation. You know, all the businesses want to open up. But for example, the Netherlands, the cases just in the last 2 weeks are up 500%. So this wow. Delta variant is an
Doctor,
issue.
Let me ask you a silly question. It's the summertime. Sure. Would you get in an airplane and go to Europe right now?
I personally, I'm waiting for the oral antiviral pill, which will be released by September by Merck. And it's going to be like Tamiflu for coronavirus, and I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable with that option. And also being closer here to antibody treatment. We have the amazing Regeneron antibody, one of my...
Well, until Europe is vaccinated, to what percentage should the American people be careful? I mean, to tell you the absolute truth, and I can go by corporate jet. I don't want to go to France. I don't want to go to Italy. I don't want to go to England right now, because why take a chance?
Well, exactly, and that's how I feel about it right now, too. I think that staycations are going to be popular, and I think until we have an oral antiviral cocktail where we can really knock out all the variants, just like we got a cocktail that finally got the AIDS epidemic under control. Remember, 40 years later, we don't have a vaccine grade, but we do have these antiviral cocktails. And I think that's how you get out of these pandemics, between a combination of vaccines, between combination of oral antivirals. We have the antibody weapon, which is working. And I know people who were fully vaccinated, got sick and got the Regeneron antibody and got better. So being close to home, you know, we're blessed to have great scientists and great corporations that have produced all these amazing options that we have. And sometimes if you're away in some remote, geographically isolated island, you may not necessarily have access to the amazing science that we have.
Are the American people covered if something happens to them in Europe?
No, they're not. And that's one of the things we've talked about in the Cats Roundtable, to educate people. Always ask when you travel get medical insurance and medical evacuation insurance. It's only about $26 a week, and your Medicare and your U.S. health insurance doesn't cover you abroad. People think in England, oh, it's socialized, but it doesn't cover Americans. There's a bill waiting for you at the airport. If you don't pay it, you can't go back into the country. And you basically pay the $26 a week. You print out your little insurance card, and then you can present it there, and all your expenses up to $50,000 will be covered. And God forbid an emergency, you will be medically evacuated.
So if you decide to fly to Europe, you're not really covered unless you make sure you're covered. And what percentage of the Europeans are you thinking about vaccinating right now?
Well, every country is different. You know, there's, Greece is like the United States is around 50% vaccinated. Then you have Australia, for example, which is one of our great allies, but only 4.5% of the people are vaccinated. And there's a big anti-vaxxer movement in Australia. And that's why they have to go into lockdown, because they know if only 4.5% are vaccinated and so many unvaccinated, if they go out and open up full force, the hospital system in a socialized country will be overwhelmed. They don't have the ICU, the capacity to take care of large volumes.
I'm getting old, and what I would say to the American people right now and say, remember that old, dinosaur record? See the USA in a Chevrolet. I mean, let's stick to the good old USA temporarily until... Why take a chance and go overseas?
Well, no, I agree. And another reason is I want to spend my money right here in the USA and stimulate and help our economy and help our country be stronger right now after we took this slap from COVID. I think it'll help. Staycations will be popular until we have a much better treatment. You know, people are itching to go places, but I don't think I don't plan on going anywhere until September when I have all access to the all antiviral for all types of coronavirus.
The other day, the New York Yankees postponed their play with the Red Sox, Boston Red Sox, because some of the Yankee players had COVID. Any idea what happened there?
Well, I don't know. Absolutely. What's happening is people are starting to go out. People are getting comfortable. People are shaking hands again. We're also seeing a rise in influenza, and I've spoken to a few doctors, and it's not even in the news yet. There's some frontline doctors that in these urgent care centers, we're seeing a big spike in influenza B. And what's happening is that people are not tugging, kissing again, shaking hands, and they think, oh, it's all great. You know, the water's fine. But all these, you know, tented up viruses have been waiting. They want to live. They want to get out there and explode. So we're going to be seeing plenty of flu. We're going to be seeing a lot of things as people get out and expose themselves to other people. But the good news is that if you're vaccinated, you have a very, very low chance of dying. And the good news, in the next 60 days when we release the antiviral pill, just like we licensed it to India, and we're going to see the death rate plummeting now in India because five companies in India are cranking it out. And I'm so happy that we're helping, you know, the world. Largest democracy is India, and the death rate is plummeting, and you won't have to see these horrible scenes of mass graves and cremation.
One last question, and I know I've asked this before in different ways. Is there any kind of intelligence behind those viruses to make them change? I'm still confused about that, and I think the American people are confused about that. Do you have any gut feeling? If it's not really a fact,
it's like human evolution. They have learned to adapt, and there are chemical signaling systems and markers. Like, they know not to attack a cell that's already infected. To me, that just blows me away. So on a micromolecular level, there are chemical signalings, and these viruses can actually communicate and know which cell is infected, which is not infected. And they know that instinctively, chemically, they know they're pre-programmed to survive, and they know that they need to become more contagious to jump into more hotels, which are humans, in order to live and survive. But eventually, they learn to coexist with us so that they can continue to live on. Because if they keep killing the human host, then they have no hotel, and that's what's happened throughout history.
So somehow there's some kind of intelligence or something that's signaling back the living viruses that you better change because the rest of us are dying. And that's the part I don't understand.
Well, there's a built-in master plan, just like there's a lot of things we don't understand about human disease and the human condition. built and master plan. And it's also part of it is whenever people got crowded throughout history in cities, we had bubonic plagues, viral plagues. It basically, the earth has a mechanism of shedding off excess populations, whether it's animal populations or whether it's human populations. And that's what we're dealing with, finding the balance to live in peace and harmony with the earth.
Dr. Peter Mihalos, thank you for everything you do for the American people, bringing them up to date. And God bless you. God bless America.
Thank you for always getting the truth out.
Exploring the truth, telling both sides with common sense thinking. Here's John Katsimatidis on Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is the Cats Roundtable.
A few days ago, I had Colonel Oliver North on my night show, but it was so good. I feel that our Sunday morning audience should hear it, too. Let's go to it now.
Well, on the line with us, we have Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. He's a decorated U.S. Marine, a TV host, a military historian. He's also a best-selling author. Welcome, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, and tell us about your latest book first.
Well, God love you. Well, the latest book is not yet out, but it will be soon, and you can get it early. The title of it is We Didn't Fight for Socialism. And I actually, almost tongue-in-cheek, one of my buddies called me up, who is in the book, and he said, I know what you did. You staged this for Venezuela, Cuba, and everything else to turn upside down just because our book just came out. Well, I mean, it is a great advertisement for this book, because this is all about why our U.S. military ought not to be taken down the path that this administration has chosen for it. It's an absolute outrage. And if you see what's going on in Cuba right now, if you look at the kinds of things that are taking place in Cuba, they're just like the Green Revolution back in 2009. They're just exactly the same kind of thing that the Cubans have not done in 62 years, but they've seen the consequences of socialism in places like Venezuela, Nicaragua, all over the parts of the world where it's been tried. It's been an unmitigated disaster. And the concern of all of our military, you know, both David Gresh and I have spent our lifetimes around military people. We've talked to thousands and thousands of young men and women who served our country, and they recognize, because if they served all over the place, they put their lives on the line, that socialism is not the answer for this country. Never has been. And what you've got going on right now is examples of why socialism is such a disaster, because it ends up with all the same kinds of things in all of these different countries. It ends up with the kinds of behavior by totalitarian dictators who can hang on just because they're dictators. Communist China is a wonderful example of this. Communist China, people are at least prosperous. But what they've done in Beijing is they've cracked down so effectively on surveillance, unlike the Cubans who couldn't do that because they didn't have the money. And everybody thought Cuba was going to, oh, once the Soviet Union no longer exists, then things will come around in Cuba. Well, they didn't. I mean, the fact is repression continued, and what you're now seeing is the young people of Cuba not rioting and burning American flags in front of the U.S. Embassy. They're going after the government, and it's a peaceful demonstration because they have no arms. And so what you're watching is young people who realize they have no future whatsoever under a socialist regime, and they're protesting against their government. And as a consequence, the Cuban machine has shut down the internet. They've picked people up on the street who simply disappeared. They've got an abysmal human rights record anyway. And the international people who've been going as tourists to Cuba, the visits to Cuba are to an apartheid setup. The people of Cuba have no idea what the bordellos are like or the Cuba Libres that are being served in those places. And, of course, they're returning back to their countries and bringing COVID-19 with them because Cuba's got a terrible outbreak of that going on right now. And so the young people are standing up and saying, you know, we're not afraid. In fact, that's one of the great signs that I saw in some of these mass protests. So what you've got is U.S. military people who've served our country in harm's way coming to us and saying, why don't you do a book about what we didn't fight for, and we didn't fight for socialism?
You're 100% right, Mr. North, and I am worried about our country. I am worried about the direction our country is going to. Is there an undercurrent? Is there foreign governments paying some of these people?
Sure. Look at Communist China. And you and I, John, talked about this when that China book, which was our very first book that we published in Fidelis Publishing, was, in fact, I've got one sitting right here on my desk with me, America's Number One Adversary. That book was used by members in the previous administration to identify the problems that Communist China was causing us. They got away with it for 8 years under Obama. They got away with it under previous administrations. Everybody was saying, oh, they're a developing country. The Communist China has within the United States, at least they had, over 70 of these so-called Confucius Institutes closely embedded with American colleges and universities in which their propaganda was being used to dispel Americans even thinking that things were bad in Communist China or that Communist China was doing bad things. And they were actively recruiting people who, when they went back home from a college or university in the United States, were enticed, encouraged, or extorted until they gave up information that we call intellectual theft, or theft of intellectual property. In other words, they came here to study, in most cases, as intelligence officers, by the way, almost all of those who came to study what we'd call the hard sciences, right?
Yes. Again,
science, technology, engineering, and math, right? They were intelligence officers. The previous administration, they said, that's it. When schools reopened in September of 2021, you're not coming. This administration is now looking for ways to waive all of that. Congress has got to act on these kinds of things because executive orders can only go so far. They stop, as we now know, from a president who's issued more executive orders than any president in history in the first 6 months of his office. And so they know that you can't make it permanent without a law, and therefore Congress needs to get off the dead duffs, stop arguing about stupid stuff, and realize Communist China is our number one adversary, and the foreign power that is actively interceding in the United States against the best interests of the United States. You know, all this socialism stuff is nothing more than Marxism, which, John, when Marxism first got going, it was all based on polarizing people based on what? Economics. In other words, the poor people will never be the rich people. Rich people will always be the oppressors, and the oppressed will never rise to the level of anybody else. Well, that total failure is exhibited by what's going on right now in Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, any of the rest of these places.
Oh, yeah.
Now what they're doing, instead of Marxism being economically motivated, it's race. If you're white, John, you and I are white, right?
Yep.
You're oppressors, and the oppressed are everybody with a darker skin tone. That's what they've done to us. This whole thing about critical race theory being taught to our military. That's my column this past week. If you go to olivernorth.com or go to Creator Syndicate, read that column. It's shocking.
Colonel, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
You know, your intelligence background goes way back to the 70s, 80s. And we have a lot of political influences right now in our intelligence community, our FBI. Deep down inside, I believe that 99.9% of our people, our intelligence people, are great people. Are they smart enough and tough enough to say yes, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir to the political people in charge and do the right thing for our country?
I'll take you one step further. I don't think that the leaders of our intelligence community, and there's all kinds of them, three-letter agencies all over the place, or the armed forces of the United States, the leaders of the armed forces of the United States, are standing up for what's best for America. I mean, when you've got...
Now I'm worried.
No, we ought to be worried. Look at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, okay, just testified in Congress that, this teaching of critical race theory and these books that they've recommended that people read, it's not a recommendation, it's an order. When I was a young Marine, and David Goetsch and I wrote this in our last column, when we were young Marines, we read things like Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and all those kinds of books because we wanted to know how our enemy was thinking. That's not the case anymore. What's now happening is people are being told to read books and material and seek out information on the Internet about things like critical race theory because our nation is a bad nation. It's totally flipped on its head. We used to go out and read about our enemies because we wanted to know what they were thinking. In this case, it's telling people what we should be thinking about ourselves. And everything about critical race theory, America is a bad place. It's run by white people. And white people are going to oppress darker-skinned people, and therefore they need to rise up against it. It's destroying the mid-ranks of the armed forces of the United States. You've got young captains and majors getting out of the service so fast and make your head spin. Recruiters are having a terrible time, even though they've waived standards that used to exist. I mean, when you can't retain the cream of the crop in the young officers and senior non-commissioned,
then we're in deep trouble.
Yes, sir, we are.
You know, it's just like the Russians and the Chinese are making them bigger and tougher and bigger and tougher.
Yeah.
And we're making them, I hate to say it, I hope we're not making them softer.
Well, if retention is a problem, then there's a morale problem. You know what? Quietly, the troops are calling this withdrawal from Afghanistan. I mean, these are guys that I covered during this war, okay? I mean, 60-plus embeds with American troops over the course of the 20 years of this war, starting in Afghanistan and then Iraq and then back and forth more times than I can. I've got the mileage to show for it. And Fox paid me a lot more to get shot at than the Marine Corps did. But I got to keep company with heroes. And some of those heroes are calling this the withdrawal from Afghanistan Biden's bug out, the way it's been done. The only good news we've seen at all coming out of this administration is they've agreed now to take, quote, some of the Terps out of the country. God help us. If we don't take them out,
they'll be killed.
They'll
be killed.
Safety, they'll all be massacred.
Colonel North, we're running out of time, but I want to have you on more often. And please, you say it the way it is. And tell us the name of the book again.
The name of the book is We Didn't Fight for Socialism. There's a website you can go to. It's called Unison, UNISON Books.com, and get it at a discount. You can also get it at Amazon. But
Colonel North, thank you. Thank you for everything you've done for our country and continue to do for our country. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you for listening to the Catch Roundtable every Sunday morning. We'll bring you the latest in what's happening in our community, our country, and the world. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Have a nice Sunday.